Welcome to the Hello First Name Podcast. The Hello First Name Podcast revolves around the term personalization and is brought to you by marketing author Rasmus Holin, founder of Omnichannel Institute and chief experience officer at the marketing automation software company Agilic. The podcast is based on the book Hello First Name. Each episode is based in turn on a chapter from the book, followed by a discussion of the very same chapter with an expert marketing practitioner in the following episode. As always, you can buy the book on Amazon or other bookstores. You can also choose to listen to it all for free on your favorite podcast service. You're also very welcome to download the abstract of the book for free, and all models, of course, are able to download. All downloads are sponsored by Agilic. I'll make sure to put a link to everything in the show notes. But you can always connect on LinkedIn, and I'll be happy to reply and help out. Part 3. The prerequisites for personalization. Chapter 15. The basic foundations for personalization. Encountering all the exciting opportunities for using personalization to drive extra value in campaigns, marketing automation, and platform projects, it's easy to get the feeling that personalization must be for everyone. It's not, however. Personalization, as we defined it in Chapter 3, is a distinct communication tactic. It's not the only communication tactic. So, if it's not a given that personalization is always a good thing to do, it's important to explore those scenarios where it isn't. In this chapter and the next two, we'll explore various topics related to the following two questions. 1. Could you do it? 2. Is it the right thing to do? Now? The first question relates to whether your organization can tick the boxes required to actually make personalization happen. In other words, do you have the necessary prerequisites? The second question relates more to the timing of doubling down on personalization. Is now the right time for your business, given the challenges that you're currently facing? 3 areas to manage well before investing in personalization. When we discussed the notion of marketing without personalization in Chapter 5, we also looked at a key prerequisite for personalization, namely the value proposition. If your general value proposition is not in place, then you don't have product market fit, and personalization will help you very little. Superficial scratches in the core customer experience can, to some extent, be fixed by timely and relevant communication. However, if your value proposition is not in place, then we strongly suggest not investing in personalization yet. Even if your value proposition is in place, there are still some fundamental areas to manage well before doubling down on personalization as the winning strategy. As shown in Figure 18, the remainder of this chapter explores these 3 essentials. Figure 18. Personalization requires that your core offering is in place, you have established brand trust and demand, and you have access to plentiful customer data. Remember that all models and illustrations can be downloaded at omnichannelinstitute.com/resources. Solid core offering. Consider your company's whole value chain, all the way from having the right suppliers to delivering service on a good product. How well oiled are those processes? Is your sales process working? Are your prices competitive? Are your website and, where relevant, your e-commerce driving conversions? Do you have the right payment options in place for the various markets to which you sell? How is your last mile delivery system? If the answer to one or more of these questions is, well, not so good, then personalization may not be for you yet. Brand trust and demand. The second thing to ask yourself is whether or not your brand has managed to establish trust with consumers. Having an unknown brand would obviously mean you'd have to answer that question with a resounding no. Therefore, if no one knows about you, then we suggest you first work more on your brand and how it is perceived, and ultimately create demand and traffic to your sales channels. Once you have created brand trust, and there is a demand for your offerings, your sales efforts and ultimately your personalization efforts will pay off to a much greater extent. According to Qualtrics, 63% of surveyed consumers responded that a company's reputation affected their purchasing decisions. This isn't that weird when you think about it. Think about how you interact with brands and how you interact with other people. It's not that different. Just as you'd be unlikely to buy a used car or anything from a person who was unknown to you or who appeared dodgy, you'd be unlikely to buy from a company with no or poor reviews. And then imagine if the person or the company somehow knew all about you. How would you feel about them addressing personal topics with you? Creeped out, most likely. budgets should be allocated to both advertising and delivering good experiences, and on getting those experiences documented in credible reviews that are easily accessible by consumers who wish to evaluate your brand. Access to plentiful customer data. Throughout this book, we haven't exactly kept it a secret that you need customer data to provide the insights needed for personalization. Customer data, and a lot of it, is the single most important prerequisite. However, companies have varying degrees of access to customer data, depending on their go-to-market model. Companies in fast-moving consumer goods have a much harder time collecting customer data than their digital direct-to-consumer peers. See figure 20 that can be downloaded on omnichannelinstitute.com/resources. If you are not selling directly to consumers, but instead through resellers or marketplaces, such as Amazon, Mento, or Zalando, then you'll most likely have very little customer data, or so-called first-party data. This will be the case for most manufacturers of consumer packaged goods and FMCG. Classic brick-and-mortar retailers will have an easier time gathering first-party data than resellers will, but they will often have to launch some kind of loyalty club in order to collect transactional data on a personal level in their physical stores. Business-to-business models have the advantage herein that most purchases will be linked to an identifiable customer that gets an invoice at the end of each month. Digital companies working directly with customers, whether business-to-consumer or business-to-business, are best positioned when it comes to collecting customer data. This category of companies naturally includes the new breed of online entertainment companies, e.g. Netflix and Spotify, but more traditional companies have also moved into this space. It's hard to run a bank, an insurance company, or even most travel agencies today without collecting a lot of customer data. However, the incumbents of these industries often suffer from legacy systems and data that is hard to integrate or even dig out for marketing purposes. Thus, having a lot of customer data isn't always a blessing. Data types. We have mentioned first-party data and third-party data several times now, so a little introduction to these data types is probably long overdue. First-party data is the data that your company collects directly from customers. It is typically gathered from transactions, subscriptions, wish lists, and other behavioral data, for instance your app, website, or e-commerce solution. If someone collects this data and sells it to you, then it becomes second-party data. Before you use this data, make sure that the consents used to collect it enable you to use it lawfully. Second-party data is probably the category of data that companies use the least. Third-party data is data that is publicly available and not necessarily linked directly to your customers or business. Often this is data of a more contextual nature. Data in this category might include the weather forecast, records within a license plate registry, today's TV programs, mosaic or consumer profiles for household addresses, statistical information on land plots, or the in-market behavior or segmentation criteria you can use when you are purchasing advertising. In 2018, the term zero-party data saw the light of day for the first time. This is data that is submitted in, for example, surveys or on My Profile pages. At first glance, the category might seem a bit unnecessary, as this data has been a vital part of permission marketing since the beginning. Prior to 2022, it was always called and treated as first-party data. However, due to the fact that this data isn't integrated with other sources or automatically updated, it starts to lose its value as soon as it has been created. For example, if a customer has informed you that she has one child, how often do you then need to re-ask this question to be sure you can count on the data? The same goes for job titles, marital statuses, addresses, and so on. In this way, you can argue that zero-party data is data that you borrow from the customer. The extra category therefore helps you to distinguish it from behavioral first-party data, for instance, transactions and purchases within the last month. Special considerations for FMCG. If we think about the bowtie of personalization and then consider the options for FMCG companies when working with personalization, it is pretty clear that these businesses face a much bigger challenge and quite limited options when working with personalization. For a start, they have very little first-party data since their resellers are the ones who own the transactions. So they are left with third-party data or the in-market behavioral data that they can access when buying exposure on paid media. This makes it almost impossible for them to do any marketing automation since they'll be lacking the data to build any insights in the form of moments of truth. On the content side of things, they do, of course, have products. However, advertising from an FMCG point of view is most often executed as a top-funnel branding exercise, leaving the resellers to do the tactical marketing campaigns. Top funnel branding is more about telling the story of the brand than it is about selling products through promotions and offers. So, taking these two things into account, it's clear that FMCG companies are pretty much stuck in the upper part of the bow tie. Naturally, there are also FMCG companies that sell directly to customers, and this allows them to collect first-party data to some extent. However, the volume of their direct selling is rarely comparable to the volume that their resellers deal with. So in terms of the money that can be made from using this data to personalize communication for the relatively small audience reachable through owned media, this is hardly worth the effort. On paid media though, a small sample of first-party data can definitely be useful when buying media and searching for lookalike audiences for first-party data segments. Value propositions with frequent engagement create more and better data. It's not only the go-to-market model that matters when you are collecting data. Some products are needed more often than others, and thus create more frequent transactions and data points. How often do people buy a broom, for instance? And there's also the matter of how much people care about certain products. Again, a broom matters little to most people. It could, however, be part of a larger assortment of cleaning products that has a specific audience if treated as a joint value proposition. As an example, Nestlé brings a wide array of products to market in the Nordics. Some of these have very little potential to gather data. KitKat, for instance. This is a very strong brand. However, it's also low involvement and therefore challenging to get data from the consumers. For most people, it will not take up much headspace that they should remember to buy KitKat. On the contrary, the decision to buy a KitKat emerges in the store and often when the KitKat is on a special offer. At best, consumers might be convinced to join fun games and sweepstakes and thus engage deeper with the brand. But it's hardly getting to any serious body of zero-person or first-person data anytime soon. At the other end of the scale, Nestlé has Purina pet food. If there's one thing that people care about, it's their pets. Their mental well-being, how healthy they are, how their fur looks, and so on. Thus, the Purina brand has a lot of potential for engaging customers and fairly easily creating a lot of data through these interactions. This is a great example of an FMCG product with high involvement. We've now covered the basic prerequisites for working with personalization. If your core offering isn't in place and your brand is nowhere, needless to say, these issues need attention before you double down on personalization as the big thing. It's also worth taking a look at your value proposition and your go-to-market model. Do these support the collection of enough first-party data to support meaningful personalization? And to what extent? Looking back at the bow tie of personalization, it's clear that without any behavioral data, you'll never unlock personalization that relies on the bottom part of the bow tie. It's one thing to have the opportunity to get a lot of first-party data. It's another to actually have it. And then comes the question of quality. The next chapter goes into more detail about the kinds of things you need to consider to ensure your data can support personalization.
Thank you for listening in on this episode of Hello First Name. Remember that all models and even a written abstract of the book are available for download. You'll find the link in the show notes.
In our next episode, which is a classical podcast format, we'll be discussing the chapter you just listened to, namely Chapter 15, The Basic Foundations for Personalization, with Jesper Damsgaard, SVP of e-commerce at Pandora. Stay tuned for a very interesting conversation on this.